And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm pleased to welcome Leah Stewart to the program today. Leah is the chair of the English department at the University of Cincinnati and is also a much-lauded writer of fiction. Her previous novels include Husband and Wife, The Myth of You and Me, Body of a Girl, and The New Neighbor. Today we'll be talking about her recently released novel, What You Don't Know About Charlie Outlaw, which is published by G.P. Putnam Sons. Leah, Charlie Outlaw from the title is an actor, and boy, has he messed up.
Yeah, he sure has.
What has he done to put himself in a bad position?
He gave an interview to a magazine that was a little too honest. He answered all the questions he was asked honestly, and he got himself in trouble in two ways. One with his fans and with the people that he works with on his hit TV show, because he said that if he were not on the show, he wouldn't watch it, and that he himself preferred more challenging shows. So a lot of people are mad at him for that. And then he also said some things he shouldn't have about his girlfriend, Josie Lamar, who, as a consequence, when the book begins, is now his ex-girlfriend.
He is newer to the fame game than Josie is. She's been famous for quite some time.
Yes. So Josie was the star of a cult TV show about 20 years before the story begins. Think something like Veronica Mars or Buffy the Vampire Slayer. She was a badass heroine on a show that some people didn't know about and some people passionately loved. And then since then, her career has had some ups and downs, but she's still very recognizable to people who loved that show and has already experienced, you know, being mobbed in a public place and having people follow her around on the street. Charlie has been working steadily, but little parts here and there. So only with this show that he's on now has he experienced this level of attention.
Now, what had he said about Josie that got him in trouble with her?
He talked about how hard it had been for her to lose the kind of status and recognition that she had, and how she sometimes struggled with not being as recognizable as she had been. And he also, the reporter asked him, is she the love of your life? And he said, so far, not meaning it in the way that it sounds, not meaning it that he thought that they would break up and that he would find someone better, but meaning it more that he felt some insecurity about their relationship. But in print, it just looked to Josie like he was saying their relationship wouldn't last. So that's really what did it. That's why she broke up with him.
And she'd had a troubled marriage before, which you really don't go much into, but I'm sure that informs the way they kind of approach their relationship as well.
Sure. I think people's history always goes with them into the next relationship.
Do you think at any point Charlie may have felt that she was holding back a bit and that may have informed his opinions of what was going on?
Yeah, that's one of the ways that I thought about it. So I mention in the book, again, you're right, I don't talk about this in great detail, but I do mention that at one point he tried to get her to buy a house with him and she didn't want to. She wanted them to keep their separate residences. And he took this as a sign that maybe she was a little less committed to the relationship than he thought she was.
And so you give this depth of character to both of these people. This is not a, from what we consider to be kind of a superficial occupation.
Uh-huh.
These are very well-drawn characters.
Thank you. One of the things that I hoped to get across is that it isn't a superficial occupation. I mean, plenty of things around being an actor and being in Hollywood are superficial and can look superficial. But for people who are really driven to acting by the artistic impulse, which is what I wanted my characters to be, it's not superficial at all.
Now, do you think novelists are a hybrid between actors and screenwriters because that there is more that goes into writing a novel than necessarily goes into a screenplay?
It's, I don't know if it's more. It's just so different. I tried to adapt my first book, and it was really difficult because this book is actually set in Memphis, my first book. It's called Body of a Girl. And it seemed, there's plenty of action in it. It has a mystery plot line. And so it seemed like a book that should be easy to adapt, but it was actually quite difficult. And the lesson that it taught me is that I really like to write interiority. So a lot of the space in my books is taken up with what people are thinking. Well, when you translate that to the screen, it all has to become external and physical. So you really have to think differently about your characters, about how you get across what they're feeling and thinking. It either has to be in dialogue or you have to find a way to demonstrate it in the scene. It's just a really different way of thinking about how to tell story. I think that in terms of being like actors, writers, like actors, need to express the emotions of imaginary people so that real people will empathize with them and share those emotions. So we do have that in common, but we do it differently.
You have very keen psychological insight into your characters. I mean, I think you get to the point with a minimum of strokes on how people feel.
Thank you.
And an actor has to do the same thing. I mean, they just have to kind of move absolutely. Their face one way to imply things.
Yes, absolutely. Right. Which I would have no ability to do. So good thing I'm a writer and not an actor.
So you don't have any theater in your background?
In high school, I did theater, but I never really did it after that. I did try out, actually, for a play. I'm just remembering this. I tried out for a play my first semester freshman year at Vanderbilt, but I didn't get the part. And then I started working for the newspaper, and that was that.
Do you remember which play it was?
Gosh, I really don't. I have no idea.
Huh. Did you gravitate toward drama or toward musicals? Or
I can't sing. So if I had continued to act, it would have had to be non-singing parts.
Forgive me. I haven't read your previous novels.
That's okay.
But in the descriptions of the ones I've read, this seems to be a bit more humor in it. Is that accurate?
I think that, you know, I really don't know, to be honest, because people keep talking about this book as comic, and one of my friends even referred to it as a comedy. And I think it's great if people find it funny. I didn't really think of it in those terms. I think that the sense of humor is perhaps coming from the narrative voice. And I did deliberately want to have an omniscient, old-fashioned narrative voice that could speak directly to the reader, that could tell you things my characters don't know, that could move into different points of view, and that could occasionally crack a joke or give you some context outside of what's happening with the characters. So I think maybe that's where the comic sensibility is coming from. I've written in the first person lots of times, and I think sometimes those characters have been wry or funny, at least on occasion. But comedy's an interesting thing. You only know you've been funny when people laugh. At least I only know I've been funny when people laugh. And one of the things that's interesting in reading from this book is sometimes people laugh at certain moments, and then other audiences will not laugh. So I'm not sure what the difference is. I don't know if it's my delivery or just the crowd.
The feel of the room, yeah.
Maybe. I don't know.
But also, I don't think you take any laughs at the expense of your characters, and that it is a very kind approach that you have to your characters, because it's not satirical. You're not trying to lampoon anything.
No, and I really was not interested in doing that version of the Hollywood novel. I think we've all seen that 100 times, right? The ridiculous plastic surgery and the overspending and the sort of needy desperation of jockeying for certain roles or certain positions, whatever it is. We've all seen that a lot. And I wasn't particularly interested in contributing to that strain of writing about Hollywood. I really wanted to get at what it is actually like when this is your job. What do your days look like? How does it feel to be all these different people? You know, how much of that experience, how much of your character's experience do you carry around with you when you're not playing that character anymore? Those are the kinds of things I was interested in.
But there is a bit of desperation starting to creep into Josie's career.
Sure, yeah.
Because she is not getting the roles. I mean, as Hollywood is not kind to women who look their age, let alone are their age.
Right.
She's now up for guest spots. She's not getting starring roles.
Right. She is at that point where she's not hot anymore in terms of, and I mean that in terms of
buzz,
her career.
Yeah.
So she had a period where she was on magazine covers and everyone wanted her, and that period has ended. And so she is at a moment where she often feels insecure and she struggles with whether to keep going, and she is doing guest spots. It's funny. The book was mentioned in Us Weekly today. It was a positive mention, but they referred to Josie as washed up. And I found that I took it personally.
She's still working.
Josie's not washed up. So I feel a little defensive on her behalf, I guess.
When we think about Charlie messing up in his interview,
We
get to see Josie in public situations throughout the course of the book. And she has an ability to say the right thing when out in public. She is very adept. Even her co-stars are often amazed on how well she can handle that public situation.
Right, yeah. Because I think perhaps because she got trained in that young, and developed a skill for that, figured out how you negotiate being in the public eye and only giving away what you want to. And Charlie has never quite figured that out, partly because of a personality difference and partly because it's come to him at a later age, that level of attention. She's a more guarded person than he is, so it comes more naturally to her to only say what she wants to say and not give it all away when she's talking to someone.
I mean, she does that calculus very well. And her friend and former co-star, Cecilia, has to do that calculus too. When she's talking about her career, she has to couch it in terms in which she isn't lording it over right. Josie or making her feel bad because of her success.
Yeah. So one of the interesting things for me about talking to various actors when I was doing research for this book is that they would tell me something about how it changes your personal relationships, for instance, when you get a job or when you don't have a job. And then I would talk to the next actor and they would tell me something similar. And I would say, oh, I heard that from someone else too. They were so excited by this. They were like, really? Because we don't even have these conversations with each other. So I found that as I was having conversations with people, one of the things I was doing was affirming for them that there were universal elements to their own experiences, because it's so awkward for them if they've been, let's say they've been starving artists together with a friend, and now suddenly they're on a show and they're making a living and the friend still isn't, that immediately this awkwardness enters into the relationship. So they don't talk about it, but they're all aware of this awkwardness.
Now, in between major sections of the book, you include quotes from famous acting teachers
yes.
and practitioners. What was it like for you reading books about acting?
Oh, I found it fascinating. I went pretty deep down that rabbit hole. I read all the books I could find in our campus library. And it was really interesting for me not only to ask myself how it is that actors do what they do, because as you were saying, people tend to feel a little bit dismissive about this career. But for most of us civilians, if told to get up and play a certain moment in a way that would make the audience cry, most of us would not be able to do that. There is something very powerful about what they're able to do. And it's not just standing there and saying the lines. It's a combination of instinct and talent and also training. So a lot of them have had years and years of training in creating an imaginary world, in channeling the emotions of their characters. And so I was really fascinated by these questions of how they do what they do. But then also as somebody whose work has some overlaps with what they do, it was interesting to me to think about how the advice that these people were giving to actors did and did not apply to writers.
Do you think you have to craft as much when you're going for an emotional response, or are you just telling your story and letting the reader have their own emotional response?
I think there's a lot of craft involved, but also, at least for me, speaking for me, and I would say this is where I see overlap with acting method, I think I have to imagine the character's emotion. I have to make myself feel it in some way when I'm writing it, and then I can express it. And essentially, there's a lot of variations on how to be a good actor through all these different books and teachers, but that's what it comes down to, is how do you tap into an emotion in yourself that you can then express as the character. So there's a deliberate harnessing of your own emotion, of your own subconscious, and channeling that toward the reader. But there's also certainly quite a bit of craft involved. And sometimes you make a deliberate decision to do something that you hope will provoke an emotional response. So for instance, in an earlier draft of the book, there was not a scene that's in there now where you see Charlie and Josie together when they were first falling in love. And as I revised the book with my editor, she felt that, and I agreed with her, that the reader needed to have a stronger connection to their love story before they broke up. So I wrote a scene where you see them together when they're first falling in love. So that's a place where it's a deliberate decision to try to draw an particular emotional response from the reader. You want the reader to care about their romance so that the reader will care that they're separated and want them to come back together.
Now, 5 novels in, is that easier to access those emotional places, or is a struggle with it beneficial to the work.
Is it easier? I don't know if it's easier, but I'm more aware of how I do it. For instance, I know that it helps me to have music that is in the same emotional key, if that makes sense. It helps me to have that music on. It helps me to read back over what I have written leading to a dramatic scene so that I reconnect with what built toward it. Sometimes you can't get there and it's effortful, but I certainly am more aware of the steps that I take to get there.
Are you an outliner or do you follow the characters?
I'm somewhere in the middle. I never know what people are talking about when they say the characters took over or the characters talked to them. That always sounds a little bit like insanity to me. I certainly imagine my characters vividly, but I'm aware that I'm in charge. I also, though, don't outline every single detail. So I have a shape more than a scene-by-scene outline. I have a sense of where I'm going. And I do, sometimes if I'm stuck, I will need to make notes about what needs to happen in the next scene or the next couple of scenes. But I don't begin with a blow-by-blow outline.
For this book, did you start with characters or a scenario?
Scenario. So I knew that this would be about an actor who got kidnapped, and that was all I knew at the beginning. And because I didn't know anything about kidnapping and I only knew about acting, what anyone who has read Entertainment Weekly knows, I started doing a lot of research. And so I did a very great deal of research before I did very much writing. And the characters emerged from the research that I was doing.
Was there anything that surprised you particularly in researching kidnapping?
In researching kidnapping, the thing that really struck me after I read a number of memoirs about people who were kidnapped, many of which were based on the diaries that they kept while in captivity, the thing that really struck me was the way the sense of self gets diminished when you lose your sense of agency. And that seemed to be a fairly universal experience for people who are in captivity. It just made it really abundantly clear to me how much we need a sense of purpose and a belief that our actions matter. And when we lose that, we do start to lose a sense of identity and a will to go on. So these people, their diaries would start out filled with detail, full of imagining what was going on at home, full of wondering how they would get free, looking around for escape routes. And then by the end, they'd be writing like one-line entry every 2 weeks, and it would say something like, I can't stop crying. So that was really striking, the way that process seemed to happen to all of the people that I read about anyway.
Comes up because Charlie decides to go to a tropical island to get away from it and try to lay low for a bit and get his head straight.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes out for a hike, and that's the worst hike he's ever taken.
Yes, exactly. So we're not giving anything away. He gets kidnapped in the first chapter. The first sentence of the book is something terrible is about to happen to Charlie Outlaw. So it's not a spoiler. But yeah, that's what happens to him. That's what sets the action of the book in motion.
His kidnappers aren't a professional band of kidnap and ransom specialists.
Right.
They're not even exactly sure what their ultimate goal is in kidnapping him.
I did that on purpose because I did read about professional kidnappers, and I read a book by a K&R negotiator. And when they are professionals, they do know what they're doing and they have all these systems in place. And it would be harder for me to make up what I wanted to. So in the same way that the island that he goes to is not a real island, it's a made-up island, so that I would not have to be bound by facts, I made my kidnappers somewhat bumbling first-time kidnappers so that I would not have to be bound by the processes that actually occur when the kidnappers are experienced professionals.
It's as almost they don't have a script they're working with.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So tell us about the lead kidnapper, Darius.
Darius is someone who has a kind of environmental local activist impulse. There's a big resort that's coming in that's owned by an American company to the island, and he wants to stop this, and that is his impulse for getting together this band of people to kidnap someone. So he has these political ideas about what he can do with the kidnapping.
And the de facto second in charge is Denise.
Yes. Denise just wants to ransom the hostages and get money.
And then there's also the most sympathetic of them is Adan.
Yes. Adan is someone who has gotten caught up in this, but is an empathetic person himself. So it's hard for him to watch what's happening to Charlie. He feels a kind of bond to Charlie, even as he's one of his captors.
Now, in addition to that loss of sense of agency that you mentioned earlier, just the sheer boredom of not being entertained.
It is really boring to be held in captivity. And there's a part in the book where one of the kidnappers brings Charlie magazines, and he's just so grateful to get his hands on these magazines. And that's something that I took from the research that I did, that any kind of reading material people could get their hands on was like manna from heaven, just because they were incredibly bored day to day.
So does the U.S. fiction market need to kidnap the entirety of America for a couple of weeks to
well, people would certainly read more. Yeah.
Does Charlie use any kind of acting techniques to help him get through his isolation?
Yep. That was part of what I ended up doing as I read more and more about acting technique. I thought, well, if this was the main thing that you did well, how would you employ it in this situation? So I had some fun thinking about how that would work.
Now, Charlie is from Cincinnati, where you're from now.
Yep.
What does being from Cincinnati inform his character with?
I think because he's from a smaller city, he's from the middle of the country, he's comfortable with a wide range of people. He's not somebody who grew up in Hollywood and always knew that business and always knew he would go into acting. He's someone who very deliberately chased that and left home to do it. I also made him one of four kids and the only boy because I wanted him to be, and he's a middle child, because I wanted him to be a diplomatic, kind of accommodating, people-pleasing, very polite kind of person.
And so how does being a people-pleaser that needs to be liked go along with his captors?
Well, he finds himself at moments trying to make them like him. And that's actually something that at times he realizes he can use, as with the Don. If he can make the captors like him, then he might have a better situation.
Real quick, can you defend Cincinnati chili?
Sure. My husband makes it at home, and it's delicious. If you get it at certain, I won't mention the various places where you can get it because I don't want to offend a random Cincinnati listener. They feel very strongly about their chili, but sometimes it can be a bit greasy. But what my husband makes at home is delicious, and it is a very interesting flavor because it's spiced differently than most chilies. It has cinnamon in it. It has chocolate in it. So I quite like it. And if you don't know, those of you out there who don't know what Cincinnati chili is, it is served over spaghetti. So it's chili meat served over spaghetti, and then you can top it with various things, chopped onions, shredded cheese, beans. The idea of putting chili on spaghetti might sound odd, but of course we put ground beef on spaghetti all the time. So if you think about it that way, it's not that strange.
But Charlie wouldn't eat Cincinnati spaghetti because he's become very health conscious in his eating.
Right. Since moving to California, he's stopped eating beef. People in California, I do think a lot about what they eat.
Well, and you can see when Josie is going through, she wants to have a milkshake.
Right.
And she goes, oh, I've gained 2 pounds and
yeah.
She's got this. It's terrible that what actors and other performers have to go through
sure.
with that.
When I did an event in L.A. last week, and Kathleen Robertson, who's an actor who was one of my sources for the book, she's a screenwriter now as well. She did that event with me, and she was recently on a cable show called Murder in the First, where she played a cop. And I think in the third season, she was pregnant, but not on the show. So they were doing the thing where they would, you know, hide her behind boxes and pieces of furniture and things like that. And she was talking about all of the hate that she got on the internet about, oh, she looks terrible. She looks so fat. Kathleen is a tiny, tiny person most of the time and was pregnant. And, you know, she steps a little bit out of line in terms of how her body looks. And all of these people just feel like they have the right to criticize that. So I think it is a really strange, high-pressure attention to their bodies. Yeah.
And so she has this pressure, the pressure of getting her career back in a positive direction, and the breakup with Charlie is affecting her greatly, at which point the 20th anniversary of her show Alter Ego comes up.
Yes.
And a man named Max that she used to co-star with comes into the equation.
Right. So Max was her love interest on the show that she was on. And they were, passionate, star-crossed lovers like you tend to see on those cult shows. And that was where I got to explore something that I talked to a number of the actors too about, which I mentioned earlier, which was this question of when you have a relationship on a show, how much of that do you carry around with you in your life? And I remember really clearly one actress telling me that she was married to a guy on a show for multiple seasons, and that she never had any kind of personal relationship with the actor. But whenever she sees him, she feels this strange unease or this strange pull toward him, as though they have unresolved emotional issues. And she's perfectly well aware that those are completely about their made-up relationship and not about anything in the quote-unquote real world. But nevertheless, once you have made your system feel certain emotions, I think there's a way in which the brain doesn't really know the difference. I mean, the brain doesn't know the difference between what you experience when you're dreaming and what you experience when you're awake. It all feels like experience. And I think there's something similar going on when you play the emotions of a character. You still carry around some feeling that actually happened to you.
And with Max, he's even more so than Charlie, able to kind of use his charisma and charm in situations to get what he wants. But still, even then, you have not turned in him to a bad guy. He's not some creep, but he is aware of the power that he has.
Yes, he definitely is. Absolutely. Yeah. I pictured him as a little bit of a smooth operator. Yeah.
I was picturing David Boreanaz in my head because he went to star on a cop show or something like that afterwards.
Uh-huh. And yeah, he did. Yeah.
Now, with the title of the book, this is as much Josie's book, if not more so.
Uh-huh.
So why does Charlie get top billing?
When I first conceived the book, I didn't know that Josie would be an equal character. I hadn't even had the idea for Josie. I had just had the idea for Charlie. And that title was with me from the beginning because, as you probably might have guessed, it's patterned after the headlines that you see on magazines. So they tend to be, so if you take Jennifer Aniston, they tend to be like 10 things you don't know about Jennifer Aniston, or Jennifer Aniston opens up, or what you don't know about Jennifer Aniston. And so that was why that title seemed to me appropriate. And I had that title almost before I wrote anything. So it just continued to seem like the right title to me.
Social media plays a role in the story as well at several points. Could you have written a similar novel prior to social media?
No, I don't think so. Because, well, certainly publicity has always mattered to actors. And even back in the golden age of Hollywood, there were all those tabloids and all the gossip and the dates and everything that were fake dates just for publicity purposes. There's always been a publicity machine around Hollywood. But social media really amplifies that, but also cracks it open in certain ways, because it's not just about the planned publicity efforts. It's about somebody who ran into somebody in the airport bathroom and surreptitiously videoed them and then put it on the web, right? That didn't used to exist. So I think that in pre-social media days, the fallout from Charlie's interview would not have been so widespread, or he would not have been as aware of it, because he wouldn't have been able to Google his name and see that all of these people on the internet were furious with him. So social media is definitely important to the situation in the book.
Our emotions have been throughout the millennia, but when we add a new factor in it, like social media, I mean, have you made any observations about how it's affecting us and how our specific situation is different from previous lives?
Oh, absolutely. So we've always had public selves and private selves, but our public selves used to be more limited in their scope than they are now. So we might have a public self at work. We might have a slightly different public self at church. We might have a slightly different public self with our in-laws or at a, you know, parent-teacher conference. But now we have these curated public selves that are accessible to anyone with an internet connection. And we are choosing through pictures, through posts, to tell stories about our lives. That's what we're doing on social media. We are shaping a public narrative about our lives in exactly the way that public narratives about actors' lives have been shaped again since the golden age of Hollywood. So we have in common with celebrities now these, again, curated public selves, these narratives that we want people to believe about what kind of life we're leading. And it's easy for those narratives to slip. You know, somebody posts something when they're drunk and it goes viral. Somebody says something ill-advised in a meeting and someone else posts it online to shame them. It's easy to lose control of that public narrative. Or there are, you know, certainly kids have put pictures up of themselves without realizing the consequences of doing that. What happens when thousands of people then come to see those pictures? So we all live in this, well, not everyone, because some people stay off social media, but those of us who are on social media live in the public sphere now in a way that we did not used to.
Being a keen observer of the human condition and psychology, and I'm sure as actors have to observe people, in the way you live your life, do you find yourself getting stuck in that observation mode, or are you able to, you're just living and you're not observing yourself?
I don't know that I ever totally turn off the observing. Maybe after I've had a couple of cocktails. I remember back just when I wanted to be a newspaper reporter. So I always wanted to write, but I didn't know how you went about being a fiction writer. I thought I would be a newspaper reporter. So I worked for my college paper, and I interned at the Tennessean in Nashville and the Commercial Appeal here in Memphis. And I remember thinking that I was putting headlines on my experiences. You know, I would even something small, like going to the grocery store and running into someone, I would think about that in headlines. So I think that when it's your job to turn experience, whether your own experience or other people's, into narrative in some way, that it's hard to shut that off. And I think that's another thing that writers and actors have in common, is that we will think, oh, I can use this. Even if it's something that is uncomfortable or awkward, that's the redeeming part of having an unpleasant experience, is that you know you can use it in some way or another.
Do you do a good enough job in disguising that when you're mining the real world to not get in trouble with the participants?
I think so. I don't think anyone has ever said to me, I can tell you're thinking about how to turn this into fiction. I've certainly had people say, don't turn that into fiction.
Do you listen to them?
Yeah. I do try to be respectful when I use something from real life. So, for instance, in talking to these actors, I said to them more than once that I would not say who they were if they didn't want me to. And so some of them are thanked in the acknowledgments and others are not, because some were okay with people knowing they talked to me and others were not.
You're the head of the creative writing department at the university.
I'm head of the English department.
Oh, English department. Wow.
Yeah.
Do you teach mostly creative writing courses, or do you teach across the curriculum?
I just teach creative writing.
What would be the number one advice you give to incoming students into an MFA program?
Toughen up is what comes to mind. I don't actually teach in an MFA program. We actually have a PhD program, which is still fairly unusual, but is growing in creative writing.
Florida State has one,
uh-huh.
Right?
Yep. So we have a PhD program. But yeah, toughen up. You have to toughen up a little bit. And some of them already have, but you have to be able to take criticism and bounce back. You have to be able to take rejection and bounce back. You have to be so certain that producing the work is fundamental to your existence that you will withstand some of the bumps along the road. And it's not easy to pursue any kind of artistic lifestyle. I will say that having spent all this time with actors, I do think it's easier to be a writer than an actor.
You have to be really tough.
Well, you know, when you're rejected as an actor, it's you. I mean, it's you playing a character, but it's still you. As a writer, there is this object between you and the response. There is this, and sometimes you've written one book someone loves and another book that someone hates. So there is this object. But if you're in the room and you audition and you get rejected, it was you.
They just weren't looking for your type, maybe.
Sometimes that's the case too, right?
You
but
can
then
tell
they
yourself that.
Drive themselves crazy trying to figure out what their type is and what type they were supposed to be. And yeah, it messes with your head doing what they do, I think.
Now, when you go out on tour and you're promoting What You Don't Know About Charlie Outlaw, but you probably turned in the manuscript 9, 15, 18 months ago.
Yeah, it was over a year ago.
What's it like to get back into that when you've probably moved on to start working on something else, and to talk about it? And
it's easier to talk about it when you're not working on it anymore because you have some distance on it. So I think it's actually better that you go out and talk about it sometime after it's done. You've had the opportunity to reflect on what you think you were doing and why you were doing it.
Do you have a bit more goodwill toward your own work and not quite as critical at that point?
By the time I'm done with a book, I tend to feel like it's the best I can do. So I don't usually feel like, well, can't fix this piece of crap when I'm done with a book. I tend to feel like, all right, I've gotten this in shape. So I felt good about the book when I was done with it. And now, even if I had criticisms of it, it's too late. So it is what it is, right?
Well, Leah, I want to thank you so much for stopping by and sharing your book with us today. It's been
thank
a real
you.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Leah Stewart is the author of the novel What You Don't Know About Charlie Outlaw, which is published by G.P. Putnam Sons. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.